Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth is your chance to create the future of humanity. After emerging from the global dark age known as the Great Mistake, the human race struggles to survive on Earth. The redeveloped nations focus on finding a new home on a new planet. Now, your leadership is needed to colonize these alien worlds, amass mighty armies, and make contact with new life forms.
Computer games, what are they doing to us, to our adolescence? Is there a pattern, even an addiction? Andy Shabilsky studies these games at the Internet Institute in Oxford.
Well, I used to play video games, but now I study them, and so I've nearly driven all of my love for the medium out of myself. But no, I study what makes video games fun, what makes them engaging, why people play them in the face of not being paid, sometimes facing social ridicule or other kinds of challenges, nagging spouses. Why would we invest so much of ourselves in a place that, strictly speaking, doesn't exist?
One of the strangest examples of that, parents, who are both academics, had a teenage son, and you sometimes wouldn't see him for 3 days, and he'd be up playing games all night, and he'd be on the phone texting his friends, who'd be doing it as well. And this was like living in another world. Does that strike you as an uncommon phenomenon, or is it the sort of thing you come across all the time?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Psychologists definitely think a lot about what makes something addictive or what makes something not. So if we have things like heroin or caffeine or cigarettes, it's very easy to identify what is the agent that is addictive that people are drawn to. We're at a stage with a lot of different behaviors, having a hobby like playing board games, where we don't really know what the secret ingredient is in the activity that draws people to it normally, to say nothing of what could be driving people in a way that might be pathological.
Well, there is some research that suggests that the areas of the brain that get lit up when you are addicted to a drug, for example, match those which some people experience when they're playing games.
Exactly right. And a lot of that same research would show that that part of the brain lights up when you receive pay for completing a task, when you see a photo of a loved one, when you pet your dog. And so the question really becomes one of, are we really measuring from a neurological perspective the things that we find enjoyable, the things that we find attractive, or are we measuring something that might just be correlated to very serious pathology?
Well, there are some of the uncertainties. What have you found?
On the topic of addiction, I found a good deal. The first thing that's very important to remember is that there might be a difference between those who are playing out of a sense of compulsion, for instance, playing because they feel like they have to play a video game, compared to those who are playing out of a sense of choice, wanting to play a game. And so in this way, the motivational quality, why someone is playing a video game, might actually be a lot more important than how much someone is playing a video game.
If the video games are such that they disturb your normal life, then we have a different kind of problem. Have you isolated that as a phenomenon to worry about?
No. If you talk to research psychologists who are very focused on studying addiction and games, they will provide you estimates. They'll say 2%, 5%, 8% of the population who play video games are addicted. And just to check in with you and your listeners, 5% of an addiction rate is massively high. In the United States right now, for instance, the main prescription pain medication, oxycodone, is probably one of the most physically addictive opioids that has ever been given in humankind. It is destroying communities, Staten Island and on Long Island and in the New York City area, for instance. They can't build clinics fast enough. The abuse rate for oxycodone is roughly 5%. So if we are to be talking about something like being very immersed in video games, and we think that the addiction rate is something like 5%, something that's on par with the most addictive prescription medication ever given to a populace, we would expect to see a massive level of societal disruption. And we're just not seeing that. We're seeing a few clinics in South Korea, a handful in China, some in the United States that are attended largely by people of means, but we're not seeing a massive wave of human suffering.
How do you explain that disparity then?
There are two ways to explain the disparity. The first is in how something like addiction is conceptualized, and the second is thinking about how addiction is operationalized. In terms of the conceptualization, video game addiction and internet addiction are typically equated synonymously with the way we look at gambling addiction or other kinds of problematic behaviors. And so there is a very heavy level of borrowing of the basic logic and ideology that underlies this mode. And these assumptions haven't actually been in any way thoroughly vetted or tested. And this fits a lot into the second part of this, which is the operationalization of gaming addiction. And what psychologists will do who are worried about video game addiction is they'll take the symptoms that are described for something like gambling addiction, they'll remove the word gambling, and then they'll put the word World of Warcraft, whatever video game you're afraid your child might be addicted to today, they will insert that video game into the scale. Then they'll give this scale to a sample of gamers out in the world, and they'll use the cutoff scores that would be used for gambling. So if you score above 42% on this pathological gambling scale that's typically used by therapists or health practitioners, if you score that same score on the World of Warcraft scale, then you might be addicted. But the thing is, that's how you get something like a 5% incidence rate. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those 5% of people who are scoring above a threshold, that what's going on with them is fundamentally different. For example, if you score above this threshold for gambling, 6 months later, there's a very high probability that if you take the test again, you will also score above that threshold. The same can't be said for any of the scales of video game addiction. So roughly right now, there are between 16 and 18 published assessments of video game addiction. Only 6 of those scales have been used in more than one study. And in only one of those studies have they followed the same people over time. And if you're to carefully look at the results of the study, specifically it was a study of 5,000 German video game players, it found that only 3 out of the 5,000 who were quote-unquote addicted at time 1 were still addicted at time 2. And you would not expect that for other kinds of pathology. Other kinds of pathology don't burn out. They tend to metastasize.
So it's early days in assessing what's going on, but here we've got the people who make these games. They're getting more and more clever at pressing our buttons. Mm-hmm. Do you see a trend there that the problem's going to increase because of the sheer sophistication of the way games are organized and sold?
I think there are 2 trends in video game design that probably merit some attention and some additional focus. The first is called a free-to-play video game. So these are games that you download on your iPad, but these games are absolutely free to play at first. But in order to advance in the game or in order to save yourself time, you need to start spending real money transactions. And actually, what you find is that the features that go along with real money transactions actually introduce some very manipulative contingencies where it's less you playing the video game and more the video game playing you in order to empty your pockets. So that's the first kind of trend I'd like to highlight. And I'm not sure actually that these video games are going to remain popular. But on the second point, in terms of a trend that probably merits some serious inquiry that hasn't found any to date, are things that are called video games. They look like they're video games, but they're essentially a gamified version of traditional gambling. So in a video game, when you play a video game, there is always some role of chance. So when creators of Nintendo created Mario, they actually put code into their game so that Mario didn't always jump exactly the same way every single time. And so when people have gone back to copy Super Mario, they think they're copying all the physics from the original engine, but between the cartridge and the game system and the controller, it introduced a little bit of almost like quantum interference. And so it made kind of your version of Mario a little bit different than the rest. So while games have always featured an element of chance built into them, what some companies are doing is taking advantage of some of the mechanics that have been built into games, and they're combining them with the mechanics from electronic gambling, such that the role of player skill is not as important for the final outcome. And money is introduced into the system. Your bank account or your online credit account of some type, PayPal or whatever, is linked to the outcome of play. And so this introduces an extrinsic orientation to the game and potentially the chance for losses. And so you have a very glossy exterior to the experience. Oh, this is just a video game. This is just something that 97% of young people do. It's not like scary gambling. It's just a video game. But within that veneer is actually a very old system of reinforcement.
Some people have suggested recently that these games, some of the better ones, perhaps, whatever that may mean, have a good educational result. Would you agree?
You know, that's a really interesting point. In the same way that we've always hoped that there will be brain training games like crossword puzzles or the like, or that getting out in nature will set us straight and reboot our cognitive clocks. Just like there have been a lot of fears placed on video games, there have also been a lot of hopes kind of heaped on their shoulders. And so when you think about video games that are great, they're typically not the ones that you think of as educational. They're educational video games, those that are designed to teach people things with a pedagogical angle, they typically aren't very fun to play. And there's a graveyard of failed government grant-funded attempts along this road. The video games that actually wind up serving the most productive role in the classroom are the ones that aren't necessarily designed to be educational. These are what video game developers and researchers in this area call sandbox games. These are games that don't actually have a clear goal of saving the princess, defeating the terrorist, or winning the sports league. Video games like Minecraft and one called Kerbal Space Program are these relatively open-ended games. Minecraft allows you to develop and create a world in which you harness resources and anneal alloys and all these different kinds of strange survival challenges that are procedurally generated in the environment. And there have been multiple modifications of Minecraft that teachers have done. So everyone actually in the classroom plays Minecraft together and they say, have a lesson on cooking or basic chemistry, or because it's a very abstracted video game, essentially it's digital alchemy. But you can teach a lot of physics lessons in the game. And so while the game wasn't necessarily designed with a pedagogical aim, it is flexible enough that inventive and creative teachers or inventive parents can use the game to teach something to the young person.
Andrew, obviously, to generalize would be foolhardy. I could say, you know, in the old days, would telephones or books have a good influence or a bad in the long term? But how do you see this field generally growing? How do you see it moving in the best of all possible worlds and the reverse?
I'll start with the worst, because I'm a realist. In the worst and probably most likely case, what's going to happen are video games will be replaced with something else that people will be very afraid of. If you look at recent technological growth, you see Facebook acquiring the company Oculus Rift. It's a company that creates virtual reality headsets that track your motion in the environment. We have a few here in the department. They're actually great. And I can imagine a world 15 years from now or 20 years from now where people who are 30 now think to themselves, wasn't it great when we all sat on a couch together and looked at the same screen and played a video game together? Now look at my kids. My kids are sitting alone with a headset and they're completely immersed in a virtual environment. And those were the days when we had two-dimensional video games. So that's where it is in 15 years, if I'm cynical. But the optimistic self that I have is that psychology and its allied fields are currently undergoing what's called the replication crisis. So we're finding out that a lot of the things that we think or we're afraid of might actually not replicate if scientists independently try to find these things out. Only the people who invent an effect can find it. And this is leading to a real improvement in research methods. So I believe, for instance, that people who are engaged in these debates around violent video games or video game addiction, they're definitely entitled to their own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And I think that if granting agencies and governments are very interested in knowing what happens with video games, what they'll do is they'll require researchers to share their data, the actual video games that they use on participants, so we can get some idea about whether or not the studies are actually done well or carefully. You know, right now, there are two large camps that are really beating each other up right now. One that's very afraid of video games and their effect on society, and another that really does just believe that video games are the latest boogeyman. And these two camps don't get along personally. They certainly don't get along scientifically, and no progress gets made because people really are just fighting about whether or not they're ruining children.
Andy Shabilsky at the Internet Institute in Oxford. Next week, a history of copulation, and on Catalyst, the physiology of crying. Production by David Fisher and Joe Wallace. I'm Robin Williams. In tears.